On the face of it, there is nothing to confront, just hypocrisy, inconsistency, while we pretend that we are alone with the standards bare and the profit shared. We should count our days.
Speeches and interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and you can hear this program on axissacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com, and we're on Facebook. Today's program is A Long View of Climate Change Solutions. Dr. Tim Flannery is an Australian mammalogist, paleontologist, and environmentalist and professor and global warming activist. He was named Australian of the Year in 2007. The moderator is Greg Dalton, who is the founder of Climate One. In this interview, Flannery explains that over the last 10,000 years, humanity has built a superorganism, a level of organization similar to that of ants, termites, or bees. And the glue that holds the superorganism together is the division of labor and interdependence. As we form this one great superorganism, where we are all interconnected, we gain the capacity to deal with the environmental challenges. Flannery sees international progress in addressing climate change and expects more in the future.
It sounds like a combination of fear and opportunity that is driving these countries. That they're concerned about the resource limits, but they also see opportunity of, I mean, if you read Thomas Friedman in the New York Times, you know, he will say that whoever owns energy technology in the 21st century will be a global leader. And China, some people believe that China really wants to own the clean energy era the way that the West owned industrial production. Is that fair?
I'm sure they'd love to. But are we going to let them do it? That's the question.
So far we are. Well, who depends on who we is. Is it America or Australia or who? But so far they're out front and they're getting further ahead, aren't they?
They are. They are indeed. But you still have enormous power in this country. And, you know, one of the encouraging signs is that California is pursuing its own emissions trading scheme, and that will foster innovation in this state. And I think give you a leading edge here.
So how does California look? You travel all over the world. California, you're based in Australia. You know, how does California look from the outside in terms of its role in this area?
It looks like a global leader and a very welcome one. Australia and California are both moving towards doing something this year in terms of getting a carbon price in place. And we shouldn't underestimate the importance of that if we succeed. They will be beacons of leadership globally.
in Australia, big, if people don't know, resource extraction economy, lots of coal, a lot of the, Australia sells a lot of coal to China. That's a big deal if such a big fossil fuel based economy is going to sort of unilaterally impose a tax on itself and make itself less competitive in very competitive international markets.
Well, you are right that we're the world's largest coal exporter. We are imposing a tax upon ourselves, but we see it as fostering future competitiveness in the Australian economy. We actually want to grow our clean tech sector, and that this is one way of doing it. And we realise we need to carry our part of the burden of this. And we know what's happening in the rest of the world. It's not like we're acting alone, yeah?
But there must be fierce resistance from fossil fuel interests in Australia. You must have some real political leadership.
Well, yeah, it's funny. The big global companies know that change is inevitable. But we do have our own version of the Tea Party, who are doing everything they can to stop advancing in this field. Yeah. So it's really, really tough. I can't tell you how tough it is at the moment in Australia.
But your new woman Prime Minister is forging ahead.
Yeah, yeah. We know things need to be done. The Australian public, by and large, want climate change addressed. There's a tremendous fear campaign being kicked up, though, that this is going to bankrupt the economy and all of this sort of stuff. But one way or another, we need to get a price on carbon and onto one of this international commitment.
And that's already happened in British Columbia in Europe. And what has that experience? How successful have those experiences been?
Well, New Zealand's got a carbon tax as well. I mean,
oh my gosh, you let New Zealand beat you?
No, yeah, exactly. No, they beat us at the rugby often enough, so it's humiliating,
ouch,
but it's reality.
Ouch.
But yeah, I know. But look, you know, the best assessment of an emissions trading scheme is the U.S. German Marshall Fund assessment of the European emissions trading scheme, which was completed last year. And it basically shows that, you know, that the scheme is achieving what it set out to do. And if you want to know what impact it's having on overall economic growth or on individuals, speak to anyone from Europe. Most people will say, what scheme? We're not aware of it. You know, there are a million price impacts on our lives. This is one tiny one. And the same is true by and large for business and competitiveness. I mean, Germany is prospering despite its very ambitious targets that it's reaching. So economic growth and putting a price on carbon are not incompatible.
Our guest today, Climate One in Silicon Valley at the Commonwealth Club, is Dr. Tim Flannery, author of Here on Earth, and scientist. I'm Greg Dalton. A couple of questions from the audience. One reads, what will prevent mankind from continuing to burn economically viable sources of fossil fuel as long as they last?
Well, what has prevented humanity from mining all the asbestos that there was on the planet? Yeah, we stopped doing that some time ago because we knew how dangerous it was. Yeah. Now, that is an individual health problem, fair enough, but we are becoming, I think, wise enough to see that there are global problems as well, which are partly health problems and partly environmental problems. So what will prevent us from doing that is two things. One is a global agreement to impose a cost on pollution. We're getting there with that. The other is the increasing investments in green technology, which become economically ever more competitive. When I look at Australia, for example, the cost of electricity from black coal, it looks as if the cost curve for that is going to cross with photovoltaics sometime in the next 5 to 10 years, you know, if the reductions in cost for photovoltaics keep going down. So what we're seeing around the world is the fossil fuels keep getting more expensive, clean tech keeps getting cheaper, and those lines will cross eventually. So between that and the global agreements we have, I think that's what's going to keep the fossil fuels in the ground.
Though you can burn coal at night, you can't get solar at night. There are some technological obstacles to having solar replace coal for base load.
Sure, there are, but they're not insurmountable ones. And as we move forward, I think we're finding new ways of getting intermittent energy integrated into the grid.
We haven't talked about nuclear energy yet, and there's a question from the audience, is nuclear power worth the risks? And clearly, you know, since the Fukushima disasters, there's been a change in thinking about nuclear. Where are you on nuclear?
I think it's an issue for every country to deal with in their own way. And just to give you a sense of where things how things have fallen out around the world, China is pursuing its nuclear program as aggressively as ever. It's going to go from 7% of energy from nuclear through to 22% by 2030. It's a massive build-out. Germany's moved away from it entirely, and Germany now faces a bit of a dilemma. You know, can it honour its commitments to reduce emissions
Without nuclear.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it's an experiment no one's ever run at that scale. I'll be very interested to see how it works out. And the world is sort of watching, I think, on this one. So, you know, nuclear, like every form of energy, has its downside. And nuclear's ones are particularly self-evident. But it's going to be part of the mix into the future, at least for some.
Do you think that some designs or some approaches are more promising or safer than others? I know you were in Toronto recently, and they're placing some big bets in Canada on nuclear, and they have a particular design that you think is safer, more viable.
Well, the CANDU reactors, or the Canadian-built reactors, have the sort of the concrete sarcophagus inbuilt in them, so you don't have to build it if there's a meltdown on those things. But the new nuclear technologies are looking pretty safe as well. You know, they rely on more gravity feed for cooling and all this sort of stuff rather than pumping. And they're smaller scale, they're less likely to go critical. So, I mean, I'm no expert in the area, but everything I hear suggests that there's a new generation down the road there somewhere which is going to be somewhat safer. But whether they'll be competitive with the renewables is anyone's guess.
And whether they can come in on cost and on budget.
Yeah,
because
exactly.
The nuclear industry has been promising for decades, oh, new ones are better than last year's. It sounds a little bit like car salesmen, right?
So, yeah, sure.
And they have, the recent history is that they don't come in on budget and on time.
Sure. A bit like clean coal. You know, we hope that we'll get good outcomes, but it's by no means certain.
Say, be everybody else, can't you see?
Tim Flannery is author of Here on Earth and is our guest here at Climate One in Silicon Valley. You mentioned population, the number that you mentioned I thought was lower than what I read was the UN. I saw 10 billion for the first time. People had previously thought that 9 billion would stabilize and that looked like there was some uplift in where world population would peak and then flatten off for the demographic reasons you mentioned. I mean, isn't that one of the biggest levers in the whole climate challenge? If population growth could be slowed, then that would have a tremendous impact on resource consumption and carbon emissions.
Yeah, it would. Look, what we're seeing with population, you can only understand by reference to the UN population projections. The one that was released today is very new, and I haven't had a chance to fully analyse the underpinnings of it. But the one that was the previous one was released 2 years ago. It suggested that global population would peak at 9.15 million, most likely.
Billion, most likely,
and that's in 2050. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting when you looked at the underlying assumptions of that modelling, because they assumed that we would prevail over the AIDS virus, that wouldn't be a limiting factor. They also presumed that population, that the family size in the richest countries would increase slightly. Places like the US and Australia have bigger families. So all of the gains in terms of reducing population was projected to come from increasing affluence and increasing education for women in the poorest 46 countries on the planet.
Which is one of the biggest things that we can do is educate women, right?
Absolutely, I mean, the single biggest thing. If we manage to do that, if we manage to increase the welfare of the poorest people on the planet, we have a chance of stabilising the population at 8 billion, right, by 2050. But that's going to take a lot of proactive foreign policy work and philanthropic work and whatever else is required. The projections that were released today were more pessimistic. They suggested that by 2050 there'd be a global population of 9.3 billion, most likely, growing slowly over the next half century to nearly 10 billion by 2100. That's a far less desirable outcome. And I haven't looked at the underlying assumptions as to why that is, but I can only guess that population growth in particularly Central and Western Africa is continuing at a higher rate than was previously thought to be previously projected.
Many times in the energy conversation, population is a taboo topic. Energy and climate people don't want to go there because it's a polarized, controversial social issue. And yet it seems like that's what you're saying is one of the most promising, though hard, places to make an impact.
Gee, I thought climate science was controversial and hard. I don't know about population.
Yeah.
Certainly live that. It's really tough. Population, it does give me great heart that the entire human species is going to go through the demographic transition in just a century and a half. That means we're self-regulating. It's one of the great reasons for hope.
A related question from the audience regarding population is, can we somehow educate people to be, if there could be more affluence and more people who are affluent, can we educate people to reduce, reuse, recycle? Can we be more, I guess, effective and efficient consumers?
It's the only way forward. We have to. We know that. We can't have a population of even 8 billion living in the way we live today. It has to be much more sustainable. The first thing that has to happen there is moving from polluting energy sources to clean and relatively limitless ones, such as solar, wind, and those other clean tech opportunities, geothermal, whatever else, and use that energy we get much more efficiently. That's the great challenge. There's food issues, there's water issues and everything else, but if you've got cheap, clean energy, you can do a lot.
Tim Flannery is author of Here on Earth, and he's our guest here at the Commonwealth Club in Silicon Valley. Another question from the audience. What has the most potential for carbon reduction to 350 parts per million, which is a measure of saturation in the atmosphere? Geoengineering or sustainable renewable energy? Might define what geoengineering is.
Sure, yeah. We're already at around 390 parts per million. So what that question implies is that we can get some gas out of the air. Now, there are geoengineering proposals which range from the mechanical way of getting CO2 out of the air through to things like biochar, harvesting the power of plants to create a mineralised form of carbon which you then store in the soil. And I think they're all really interesting approaches. But scalability is an issue with them. Can we make an impact? Could we draw down one part per million per year or something like that? You know, that's a really enormous ask, and we're yet to be anywhere near that. I think we need to continue aspiring to that. Some of the other geoengineering projects which might involve, say, using dimming agents in the atmosphere, so putting sulfur in the stratosphere, for example, they don't help reduce the concentration of CO2, but they sort of mask the impact of the warming because they reflect sunlight back into space rather than letting it hit the surface of the planet. We might need to use all of those options in future if we're not as agile and good at dealing with this as I hope we will be.
So you advocate research into exploring, developing those tools in case we need to go for the emergency fire extinguisher at some point?
That's right. I sit on the Harvard-based group looking at geoengineering options, and you know what we are strongly advocating now is more research on what the impacts of any geoengineering proposal is likely to be. We're horrendously under-informed about that sort of stuff, and also promoting discussion of how we will agree to use any of these global mechanisms should the need arise.
Who gets to pull the trigger, and what group of humans do you trust with that power?
That's right. They're all big questions. Yeah.
I'd like to bring on a friend of us all, Mr. Bob Dylan.
Sad forest. I've been out in front of a dozen dead oceans. I've been 10,000 miles in the mouth of a graveyard. It's a hard, and it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard rain's gonna fall. Oh, what did you see, my blue-eyed son? Did you see my darling young one? I saw a newborn baby with wild wolves all around it. I saw a highway of diamonds with nobody on it. I saw a black branch with blood that kept dripping. I saw a room full of men with their hammers bleeding. I saw a white ladder all covered with water. I saw 10,000 talkers whose tongues are all broken. And it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard rain gonna fall. What did you hear, my blue-eyed son? And what did you hear, my darling young one? Sound of a thunder that roared out a warning. I heard the roar of a wave that could drown the whole world. I heard 100 drummers whose hands were ablazing. I heard 10,000 whispering and nobody listening. I heard one person starve. I heard many people laughing. I heard the song of a poet who died in a gutter. And it's a hard, it's a hard, and it's a hard, it's a hard. It's a hard rain gonna fall. Who did you meet, my blue-eyed son? Who did you meet, my darling young one? I met a young child beside a dead pony. I met a white man who walked a black dog. Body was burning. I met a young girl, she gave me a rainbow. I met one man who was wounded in love. I met another man who was was wounded in hatred. It's a heart, it's a heart, it's a heart, it's a heart, it's a hard rain for a fall. Oh, what'll you do now, my blue-eyed son? And what'll you do now, my darling young one? I'm going back up for the rain starts falling. I walk to the depths of the deepest dark forest, where the people are many and their hands are all empty, where the pellets of poison are flooding their waters, where the home in the valley meets the damp dirty prison. The executioner's face is always well hidden, where hunger is ugly, where souls are forgotten, where black is the color and none is the number. And I tell it and think it and speak it and breathe it, reflect from the mountain so all souls can see it. And I stand on the ocean until I start singing, but I know my song well before I start singing. And it's a heart, it's a heart, it's a heart, it's a heart, it's a heart. Gonna fall. It's a hard rain gonna fall. It's a hard rain gonna fall.
And now for something completely different.